Radio Network, the one remaining non-corporate radio network in this country, and we are happy to do this work for you, the listener. Stay tuned.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 10:59 a.m. Next up is The Dirtbag.
Well, it is alarming and charming. It is to be a farming. Jim, it's hard to believe we're here at the studio live across from each other.
That is amazing, Glenn.
We're back.
Yeah.
Well, we're back again anyway. We had to, we couldn't do it last month due to some snafus, we'll say, on our part. And we apologize for that, but we will be presenting that information and more. So we've got 2 months of information in this month. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. And the Jim I referred to earlier is Jim Gilbert.
Sitting right across from you, Glenn, and I do also want to apologize for last month. It was people listened to the show, and I think some folks didn't realize that they had to play a recorded show from January,
yeah.
And we're talking about snow or frost and hold it. This is not that kind of weather we're having right now. So anyway, we're back and it's good to be here.
Yep, it sure is. And we thank Ty for coming in too to be our board operator and Joe, who is learning how to be a board operator. We welcome both of them too. It's just the four of us, or maybe there's another person in the station, but otherwise we're it. Well, we've got a full show, as I mentioned, and we'll get started. We do have a new plant of the month. We've got a new garden stumper. You know, some of this stuff we'll have to gloss over because it's not as appropriate for this month as it was for last month. But, for example, protecting apples from larvae, and Jim's going to talk about diseases that might have been more prevalent because of all the rain that we had. And that'll be the subject of our tunes too, all related to rain. Because in June we were having that,
lots and lots of rain.
Not so much now. And that also leads us to slug control, mm-hmm. which we will cover. That's good for any time of the year, really.
Yep.
And other things, including what's annoying me. I've been waiting 2 months for this one here, and we'll just get that out of the way so I can relax. Actually, it's not that big of a deal. But it is what I have termed the standing ovation inflation. I was visiting my wife's relatives, in Alaska, Juneau, Alaska, here a couple weeks ago. And they were right with me on that. They said, "Oh boy, it doesn't matter to them." The object or the thing being is that no matter what, people will give a standing ovation to this, to a performance of any order. And so that kind of cheapens then what a real standing ovation is. I was talking with my mother, who's almost 92 now, and I didn't even mention this, and I don't know how the topic came up, but she said that she was reading about some famous maestro who said that a true standing ovation, at least in his opinion, was when everybody stands up simultaneously because it was such an astounding performance. What I would consider, and then he went on to say, and I agree with him completely, is that the standing ovations that we often get now are, oh, a couple people stand right up, that always do, and then others look around, oh, well, they're standing up, maybe I should stand up too. Oh, well, then everybody kind of gets up too, you know, peer pressure, if you will. So I continue to sit.
So I have an idea. Because I like to stand, and much better for my body than sitting.
Yeah.
Why don't we have a sitting ovation? And everybody stand normally, and then when something special happens, everybody sits down and claps.
Well, that seems to me that would be more trouble, especially if you're standing the whole performance.
Well, of course, we could take breaks and sit down.
Yeah, but, okay.
Anyway.
Okay, well, anyway, that's my annoyance, and I'm sticking to it. So, Jim, how you been?
Well, it's been a busy time, largely catching up with all the work we couldn't do because of the rain. And that still continues. A lot of things we didn't ever get really couldn't get done because it was just so darn wet. On the other hand, I can't complain too much because there's a lot of soil moisture. Plants were happy, not much stress. The plants are growing well.
Yep.
I think fruit crops are late. I had a friend of mine who grows grapes told me his last thought was they're about a month behind. Now, this warm weather we're having or had is obviously pushing things
catching up a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. The only things that I track quite a few things for blooms just because of my curiosity and the relationship that my honeybees have with them. And the lindens, the basswood, the tildens, mm-hmm. they were a little later this year, but not a month by any stretch. But of course, plants have different flowering habits. And as far as the honey production goes, or timing of that, generally it ends, the second, third, maybe fourth week of August, or excuse me, July, and it's still going. And how do I know that? Because one of my hives is on a scale, so I can monitor the average or the daily weight gain or loss. And yesterday they put on 3 pounds, so that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great in late May or into June. They've put on 5 to 8 pounds. Sometimes when you think about that a bee in its lifetime only produces 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey.
That's putting 5 pounds of honey into a hive in one day. That's crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Really, it's nectar, but, that's the net gain.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Well, since we are live here, let me mention that if you do have a gardening question, you can give us a call. What a concept. 503-231-8187. That's also the number that you would call to answer the garden stumper that's coming up at half past the hour. Well, let's start with our plant of the month here, and it was very appropriate for last month, which is day-neutral strawberries. You ever heard of these, Jim?
Yeah.
I'll just read this if I can. Boy, this light in here is not so good. But we'll try it here. In the 1970s, day-neutral or remontant, you ever heard of that word, Jim?
Nope.
Strawberries were developed at the University of California. Day-neutral strawberries flower throughout the growing season as long as temperatures are below 90. Periods of hot weather will cause a temporary gap in fruit production. day-neutral strawberries do not produce as many runners as the other types, so they are usually grown commercially with plastic mulch in a hill system, where runners are removed to maintain individual plants. This type of strawberry can be grown in annual or perennial production systems. Distinguishing between everbearing and day-neutral cultivars can be confusing for the home gardener, and I'll just interrupt here in saying, oftentimes we just say anything, call anything that fruits more than once everbearing. Not sure why and how that came to be, but that's why we're distinguishing them from these so-called day-neutral varieties. Day-neutral cultivars are, quote, everbearing, whereas the old everbearing cultivars produce two distinct crops, one in the spring and one in the fall. Interrupting here again, this is also true for some raspberry varieties. Two crops, rather than there is no such thing as a continuous raspberry crop as far as I know. Jim?
Don't know of any.
Okay. No. Furthermore, both day-neutral and everbearing cultivars are usually sold as everbearing in retail nurseries. Dang. No wonder it's confusing. And then there's other, an exotic and tasty Native American fruit is, we won't talk about that. But so we have the day-neutrals, the everbearing, and then we have the June-bearing. And the June bearings are like Hood, or there's Shuskin. There's quite a few varieties of those. If you're going to do canning or something like that, June varieties are great because they produce a lot at once. Mm-hmm. So that's our plant of the month.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Well, I do want to talk about next, Jim, this is just a heads up, Ty. We're going to get to our first musical selection here next, about diseases, and we were going to talk about possible diseases that they could get, and now we can talk about not only that, but was this true? But first, I'll take a musical break here. Like I said, all of our tunes are related to rain, and the first one is from Larry McRae, 3 Straight Days of Rain. Yeah, right, we haven't had that. Okay, Ty, you ready for that one? Let's hit it.
Well, I couldn't say yeah, I couldn't say no, I couldn't say a thing. As she turned to go, she had a one-way ticket. I heard the screen door slam, tires were burning. Well, I could raise my hand. Make a poor one rich, make a grown one cry. Now the rain keeps falling, fall from my eyes. Can't you hear the thunder in my heart? Lightning strikes closer every day, feel it hard.
Please stay in the rain.
And that's just how long my baby's been gone.
Don't think I can stand the pain.
It's driving me.
Larry McRae there, 3 Straight Days of Rain. You know, pretty soon we're going to be wishing for rain.
Yeah, 3 days. And I didn't count the straight days that we had, but there were a lot of them that were probably more than 3 days.
Yeah, record spring rain.
Yeah.
April, crazy. May, and June.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's get to some results of that rain, maybe, and fruit diseases that may or may not have manifested themselves.
Yeah, I think this year was a good... we have this test orchard area. We're basically trialing a bunch of varieties, and so this was a good year to test things because it was the effects of all that rain... pushed all of the the plants that are susceptible to disease to the limits, and I had to sharpen my electric chainsaw a couple of times.
let me just interrupt to clarify. When you say test, is it just diseases that you're testing for, or are there other things too?
Yeah, the disease resistance is really important. Let's, for example, peaches. So we have about, 300 peach trees, varieties, and seedlings that we're evaluating for. One thing is a disease resistance. Of course, another thing is fruit quality. Another thing would be vigor and how they grow. So all of those things we look at. But of course, before you can have fruit, you have to have the tree.
Yeah.
If the tree dies, then the test is over.
Yeah.
And that's what happened this year with a lot of them. You know, that bacterial canker, and primarily all that rain just was really tough on prunus. And I'm sure there are listeners that are wondering, you know, why they have dead branches on a tree, of peach tree, or the tree possibly died. So, you know, we learn from this. And
what are other prunus that gardeners should be looking for?
Well, cherries, of course. They didn't suffer quite so badly. Plums got hurt. Anybody that's tried to grow an apricot, I have sympathy for them, compassion, because we try it too, and we had a lot of chipping to do after the apricots died, which we this is a big project we're working on, but it's getting smaller. Although, and we still have some fruit trees that look good, but no fruit this year, which I was gonna. That's another story I'll mention after we talk more about the disease part, but. Prunus probably, at least, it's probably the most susceptible of the genus, the different genuses that that we grow. So, you know, that includes almonds too. And almonds generally are pretty disease resistant. They're probably the easiest one to grow of all of those of all of the prunus types. Peaches, nectarines, cherries, plums, flowering apricots, and apricot, and so forth. So. That showed the least amount of disease. And then also, when you go to apples, fire blight, which people used to say was never a problem in Oregon because we wouldn't have a rain and warm weather at the same time. That's no longer the case.
Hmm.
So now we have fire blight, and there are susceptible varieties more so than others. And pears, the same thing. Quince is really, really susceptible, and so far we really haven't found a super, super resistant variety yet, which is too bad. The Willamette Valley has a lot of good things going for it, but when it comes to growing fruit, there are challenges.
Yeah.
And one of the goals we've had for many, many years at our nursery has been to find varieties and promote varieties that are resistant to disease. Because, like I said, it doesn't matter if the fruit's the most delicious fruit in the world. If the tree's dead, you're not going to get any.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
You know,
so these trees that didn't pass, so to speak, you're just scrubbing them out.
Yeah. Yeah, and the ones, there are some that have like dieback and some branch death and so forth, and depending upon the severity of that, we'll decide to leave it for longer and test it another year. But if it's pretty severe, we generally remove the tree because there's no point. It hasn't passed the test. And this year, this apricot project we took on, gosh, it's probably been 5 years now that we've been planting varieties of apricots and seedlings. It's fascinating, really. Like my partner Lorraine says, well, if they die, it's data. To which I say, well, I want to eat the fruit, so you can't eat data. But this year we got a lot of data, and I said, was out there removing trees, but there are a few examples, the ones that so far look pretty good. And if we miss, if we can find a variety that will bear fruit and stay alive reliably, and we might miss a year of fruit, that's okay, as long as the plant still can survive. So.
Well, we talked several months ago about this big apricot in Northeast Portland here. I'll go by that here, run by some morning, and check out, see what it's doing.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to know. And I think I mentioned there was another one in a yard of a friend of mine. I'm hoping to go check that out soon myself. I think he's probably going to remove that tree. It's a big old tree, but it has no top. I mean, it's so much dieback has happened on it. But we did propagate that one, and I don't know that we were able to successfully propagate the one from Northeast, but we're going to put the, when we do, we'll put them both in our trials and see how they do, you know, out at the nursery.
You're saying the Scion wood that you took hasn't taken, so to speak?
Yeah, I don't think we were successful with the one that you showed us, but the other one we got a couple of plants from. We were kind of late getting that wood, and this year we'll get it.
Try it again.
The best time to get it's in August for budding, and that's the best way to do prunus propagation is actually budding instead of grafting. So, we'll give it another try.
So the rain gave us data, but not as much fruit.
Yeah, and there are you know, apples. We've got a lot of pretty good fruit, apple crop.
I've got pretty good plum crop in my green gauge.
Good.
Cherries, it was pretty good, except the squirrels got the cherries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just need to figure out a way. Here's an idea, Jim, that I've been thinking about how to protect cherries on a smaller fruit tree. And you know, we've heard about these fruit socks for apples. Mm-hmm. Well, what if we were to make fruit leggings? Or, you know, a netted thing that you could just put over a branch, a whole branch.
Yeah, sure.
Because cherries have a different growth pattern than apples.
Yeah.
You know, it's more
linear. Sure, that would be an interesting idea. I mean, cherries and birds are really well connected, and cherries usually are up high where birds can go to get them without, you know, not be in danger of cats and other things.
Well, I've pruned this using the Spanish pruning method. The cherry trees, that's just good for the cherries. And so I keep it pretty small. And so it's not birds that are, I think, it's squirrels.
Tell us about the Spanish method, if you wouldn't mind, briefly.
Well, I mean, you can read all about it at the Oregon State University Extension Service. But I was first introduced to it, I don't know, 10 or almost 15 years ago, probably, with Ted, our colleague Ted Svensson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And essentially you kneecap it. Went out there and stood next to it. Oh, there's about my knee, and I chainsawed it. And this is only good for cherries because the rootstock responds to that. And then it'll send up shoots from that below that that place. And then you can just continue to do that. You're cutting off branches, keeping it small.
Mm-hmm. How often do you do it? Every year?
Every year, yeah. Mm-hmm. Prunes it. I mean, you don't chainsaw it every year.
Yeah, right.
After these. yeah, we get a lot of data.
Yeah, good.
Lorraine's never going to live that one down, right?
Well, you know, I remember you telling me about that method a long time ago, and I actually cut a tree. I had some trees that we were going to remove, and I thought, well, I'm going to try this thing. So I actually cut them back, but I didn't know what to do afterwards. So,
Go to the website, and, you know, you can, you know, after they grow big, then you cut it back like you would summer prune.
Uh-huh.
Essentially.
Yeah, cut the tops back?
I cut it back to the, because they'll produce fruit on old growth too.
Uh-huh. Cool.
So, yeah.
Neat.
Yeah, because there really isn't any true, you know, dwarfing rootstock for cherries, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is unfortunate.
I mean, there's it'll dwarf it, but a big cherry tree is, half a big cherry tree is still a big cherry tree.
It's funny, as part of our research, we're also doing rootstock trials, and we've discovered that there were some new rootstocks introduced for cherries and peaches and so forth, and we've tried them, I think that they are designed to grow well in drier climates because they've not done well for us. And despite promotional literature we read and all that, we just really haven't had good luck with them. So, you know, we're kind of sticking with the old stuff, and which is most reliable for us. Uh-huh. So we put, like, for example, peaches, we graft on peach seedling, and it makes a good long-lived tree.
Huh.
You know? Cherries we do on mazard rootstock, which is just this basic seedling rootstock. It will make a big tree if you let it grow, but using your method of pruning, you know, keep it small. There's some cherry rootstock, Gisela rootstock, that you know, that some people have had good luck with, but it's not been so good for us.
No, that's what I think I have Gisela 5, and I think there's a 6 now, but you know, the idea was that, oh, this will, you know, a cherry tree will be small, but no.
Yeah.
Didn't happen.
Yeah, I was going to also mention, I talk about apricots because apricots, one of the reasons that we took on this apricot trial was because I really love apricots. And they're one of the very best, to me, fruits in the world. And you can't, you know, what we go in, if you go into a store right now, there are apricots on the shelf, but they're just hard and they don't taste very good. And they're, they look like apricots, but they're very poor substitute for the real thing. So that's why we wanted to grow them. But we also we discovered a couple of years ago a little orchard, and this is kind of a special piece of information for the listeners, because the closest apricot orchard to Portland and the Willamette Valley, as far as I know, is in Mosier, just east of Hood River, and I actually visited there on Monday. It's called Annie's Apricots, and Annie and Bill have this small but thriving apricot orchard of old trees, but loaded with fruit, and they're not that far away. So you can go online and find that. Just look up Annie's Apricots, and if you'd like to take a drive out in a real pretty part of Oregon and get some ripe ones, you can call Annie and just tell her what you want.
They're producing now?
Yeah, just starting. Yeah.
We used to
drive further. You can go all the way to Highway 97, Biggs Junction, cross the Columbia River, and there's a fruit stand on the other side, and there's some apricot orchards, but large ones, down along the Columbia River, kind of just down the hill from Goldendale, but that's quite a bit further.
Yeah.
So,
well, another benefit for listening to The Dirt Bag.
That's right.
You heard it here exclusively. Annie's Apricots.
Annie's Apricots.
Yeah. All right. Well, I wanted to mention something about protecting apples, you know, from the larvae and whatnot, and I'll just mention it. It's really too late now. The idea is that you're going to put a little prophylactic bag on each apple, and it will prevent these worms from the codling moth and the apple maggot. We call them worms. They're really larvae or maggots. And you do it when the apple is quite small and before these pests are around. And you may have had a little bit of a reprieve this year. You could have probably done it till mid-June or so. Have you seen any of the flies or anything, Jim? Maybe you don't even have that issue.
You know
where you're at.
I don't honestly have much time to look at the flies.
I just glanced at some apples yesterday because I didn't put many bags on this year, and it looks like there's a problem.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
The apple maggot fly is actually quite pretty.
Hmm.
It's a, when you look at it, it looks almost like it's upside down because of the markings on the wings. You know, maybe it's to confuse predators or me.
Is it like a fruit fly size? Or
no, it's a larger fly, but smaller than the domestic house fly.
Huh.
But
yeah. We don't seem to have that in our fruit. I mean, I harvest a lot of fruit, and basically the fruit is kind of a byproduct of the nursery, so we don't spend a lot of time dealing with it. But I haven't had we don't have apple maggot.
Well, that's good. Do you have the codling moth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, to get back to this prophylactic treatment, you can buy products that are nylon or netting or mesh. Mesh wouldn't, I mean, it'd have to be very small mesh to prevent these insects from getting onto the apple. and laying their eggs. But with a bag, I still use paper bags just because they're compostable. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have to be as careful in the garden and just compost it when I'm raking up or picking up. And we're just cutting a little slit in the bottom of the bag and then slip that, turn the bag over, slip it over the small apple, you know, maybe fingernail size or thumbnail size, and the apple, the slit will close and it will, you just hang it around the stem and it just, and I put a staple in the bottom of the bag and it just hangs there for 2, 3, 4 months.
Hmm.
Well, probably not 4 months. If I'm putting it on 1st of June, I'll usually take it off by the end of August or so. And the apple will continue to grow, mostly, almost 100%, not quite, but pest-free, and take it off the end of August and let it expose it to the sun, and it will color up then. And then the reason we wait until then is because that's when the danger of these pests are over.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, it would be the end of May, beginning of June, and while you're out there putting the bags on, you can also thin, and that's very important with apples if you want nice, eye-pleasing,
mm-hmm.
mouth-watering, teeth-crunching apples.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's the quick and dirty primer on protecting apples. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind for next year, and we'll certainly remind you on that. Okay, we're at half past the hour. Do we have our Garden Stumper theme ready to roll there, Ty?
Yeah, I get it.
Okay, it's time for the Garden Stumper. Jim's, we're not going to leave the topic of fruit quite yet.
That's correct. Yes. So, we talked about rootstock a little bit earlier, and just so the Garden Stumper really is connected to that. And there are some rootstocks for apple and also for pear that are identified by letters and numbers. And so, for example, an apple rootstock might be M-26 or M-7. A pear rootstock would be OHXF-333. And so the stumper is, tell us what those letters mean. And so Glenn and I talked about this, and we thought, well, if somebody wanted to guess, can get one right, you can win. If extra credit, you get both of them right. No, I don't think that means sharpening two tools.
Well, I don't know. Maybe we should have two people.
Yeah, well, there's right. That, yeah.
Yes. Okay, so that's it. What do those letters stand for in the M26 and the OHXF-333?
Yep.
If you know the answer, or you want to take a guess, or if you have a garden question, please call 503-231-8187. And the winner will get a free sharpening of a garden hand tool at Coley Farm Store in Northeast Portland. And this includes pruners, loppers, shears, shovels, hoes, probably other hand tools. Hand scythe, I suppose.
Fingernails.
I'm not sure he would do that, or you'd want to do that.
You know, there's a Russian word. I taught my grandkids this Russian word for joker, and so they tell me now, shootnik. The word for joke in Russian is shootka, and shootnik is a joker. So, I am the shootnik.
So that's where we get Nick for a lot of anglicized words,
yeah,
like a beatnik.
Well, maybe. I mean, yeah, it could be. It's a person, basically. The word, the joke becomes the person telling the joke.
Well, like a beatnik, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Should have saved it for a stumper.
That would be more challenging, I think, unless there's Russian speakers listening. Which that would be
well, we know there are, because you've spoken in Russian to some.
I remember a long time ago, somebody called. Yeah.
Well, let's give a brief talk about what's going on in the garden and farm. You mentioned that somewhat. What I'll mention in the garden is what I'm finding problematic, and an easy way to take care of it is that grapes this time of year can get very unruly. They send out, you know, massive new growth. And if you might want to preserve the main growth on the new growths, these canes, but it'll also have side growth even from your existing canes. And they can just, I mean, they'll be 5 or 6 or 10 feet long too. And they'll grow out and twirl around anything. It is perfectly fine for the plant to prune those off. It might weep a little bit, that is to say, water will drip out, but that also is not an issue. So prune away. Also, this would be the time, generally mid-July to mid-August, that you could do summer pruning. This is what I do. My fruit trees are all the size that I want them, and so I just keep them the same size year after year. I'm doing that to a pear tree that's probably a standard size pear tree, and so I don't even want to count the number of cuts, but it's probably well over 1,000 of these shoots that come out. But my battery operated chainsaw has taken care of some of that. I just cut off some of the branches. If there's no branch, there's no fruit or new growth on there too. So those are two of the things that you can prune, work on in your garden there.
I'd like to mention pineapple guava, because it's blooming at least out of the nursery right now. It might it may be a little further along here in the Portland area, but the flowers are striking. Anybody that has a space for one, and they're not big plants, if they don't have one already, you should definitely plant one, and basically better two. And then what you do, in their native range in Brazil, they're pollinated by birds that eat the sweet flower petals, which we can eat as well. Also in New Zealand, where they did a lot of breeding work with pineapple guava, birds also do the pollinating. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to figure out how to train the birds here to do that. And so I thought about it, you know, maybe make a cage around the plants and put some birds in there and see if that's all there is to eat. Maybe they'd learn. But we get fruit set anyway. I think there's some insect action that happens. But if you've got a pineapple guava plant or a couple of them in bloom, I would suggest taking a flower from one and just dust go over to the other one and do a little dusting around that for the other flowers. You know, you can do several flowers with one and go back and forth between the two, and you know, you'll definitely get some fruit. And the fruit is quite good.
Yeah, it's unique.
Yeah,
can't really compare it to anything else that we grow.
Yeah, and I just think it's a great garden. It's a beautiful evergreen shrub for the Northwest, for this west of the Cascades.
I saw one recently blooming, so I think we're still in the bloom.
Yeah, we're bloom. That's one thing we're doing right now is pollinating. We have also a variety trial of those, and so we're trying to make sure we get fruit so we can test it. We had kind of a funny story. We brought back went to Brazil, and we bought some fruit in the market, and we cleaned it and brought back seeds and planted them. And I thought, well, you know, if they're commercial fruit, they're going to be good. But unfortunately, those plants, the fruit was terrible, and it was like we had to taste each one. And I said, no, I have to want to taste any more of these because they were really bad. It's funny because I don't know where, you know, why they didn't taste so good, but the ones that we've grown from seed from New Zealand, and also of course the varieties that have come from there, have been excellent. Really good.
How disappointing, because that's what, several years worth of
data
collection.
Write a small book.
Yeah.
Yeah, data collection.
Yeah.
And also, I thought I should mention that my neighbor across the street who grows organic blueberries is busy harvesting right now. Just started with the Duke variety.
Oh.
And next up is Reka, I believe. And there's, I'm sure, other varieties in the valley that are getting harvested.
Huh.
But that's another really nice crop for us.
Coming on.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's take our second musical break here. This is from an earlier Coldplay album, Prospects March. And once again, getting right in line with our rainy theme here from last month. This is called Rainy Day. Okay, a rainy day. Okay. Francesca, good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning. Does the M prefix refer to the, is it the Malling series where apple rootstocks were first developed?
Yes, indeed it does.
That was the perfect answer.
In 1912. What was the other question that you had?
Well, the other one was, what does OHXF stand for in... That's the pear rootstock.
Oh, I didn't catch that part of the question.
Well, you only need one.
Yeah, but if somebody wants to, if somebody knows the other answer, we will accept that too, right, Glenn?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed,
so,
we will.
Yeah.
I'll give both names to the Coley Farm Store.
Okay. Cool.
And so,
thank you for your show.
You're welcome. If you hang on to the, and Ty will get your. Well, I've got your name here, Francesca, so I've got it.
You need contact information.
Yeah. So.
Oh, okay.
You win a free gardening sharpening at the Coley Farm Store.
Gosh, we need it.
Oh, boy. You know, it makes such a difference to have a sharp tool. It's just almost fun to do
really
things.
Does.
The right tool.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's at Coley Neighborhood?
Yeah, Coley Neighborhood, 42nd and Alberta.
Okay, great. Thank you. You have a good day.
Yeah. Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
Who do we got? Paul. Morning, Paul. You got a part
good
two
morning.
For us?
Good morning. Hey, I don't have an answer for you, but I have a gardening question.
Oh, we'll take those two.
Excellent. So it's a persimmon question.
We can do that.
So so my persimmon tree, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago I planted it, and it took until last year to produce one persimmon, exactly one. And this year, it's got like hundreds. And so the question is, well, first of all, was it like the wet spring? Is that normal, or was it the wet spring that made it produce so many? And then I read that you need to get rid of some of them so you don't kill the tree by breaking all the branches. So could you guide me through that?
Okay, sure. So first, the weather, we're fortunate. The persimmons bloom late, so they're not affected by the weather. So the weather is not the tree is just getting more mature and now bearing more fruit. That's great. Do you remember the name of the variety, Paul?
I don't.
Okay. Do you know if it's astringent or non-astringent?
I believe it's non-astringent.
Okay. Well, so it doesn't. They don't need pollination, and that's why you have all that fruit. I wouldn't personally take anything off until you actually see there's potential of any of danger of too much weight. Persimmon trees.
It's just a small tree, though. It just doesn't seem like there's any way it could handle that many persimmons.
Well, they also have a habit of dropping them if they're overbearing. How do you take care of it? What's your watering routine?
Well, I really haven't had to water it until recently because it was so. Yeah, sure. Now I think I watered it like twice since the rain stopped.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I would not overwater it, but I think that's good. And like I said, a lot of times though, if they have too much fruit, they'll drop some of it. So I wouldn't worry about removing anything just yet. You know, when they get the fruit gets bigger. And it's still hanging on, and you look, it feels like it's getting too heavy. Sure, you could take a few off, but I've never had to remove fruit from all. We have many, many persimmon trees. We've never had to take any fruit off purposely.
Okay.
Could he also prop the branches up since it's a small tree?
Sure. Yeah. You could put post little poles underneath them and hold them up. That would help too. If it's
okay.
Cut a little V in a fence board or something, and
right on.
Yeah.
Okay, but, well, cool. Thanks a lot.
Well, and you're lucky, I mean, that's very fortunate to have a good crop.
And I think the reason that you just had one previously is that it's a fairly young tree. Like Jim said, I just wanted to reiterate that.
Yeah, just getting more mature now and ready to bear. So that's good.
It'll be worth it. You bet. Thanks, Paul. Okay, what do we got next here? Let's talk about... Let's cover our Dirtbag Dictionary term first. Healing in. We've mentioned this in the past, but I thought we should spend just less than a minute on healing in.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be healing in anything now, Jim?
No.
Healing in is a term that we'd use to temporarily store, if you will, a plant that has exposed roots, a bare root tree. Or a bare root plant. It could be a rose bush for that matter. And is it only bare root plants that we would heal in?
In my understanding of the term, yes.
Yeah.
And it could be a very short time. It could be a longer time. But basically, wherever you're healing it in is not going to be its permanent location. It's just a place to keep it. Usually, like what when we heal in things, it's in sawdust, for example, where we're just holding it for usually not a long period of time.
Wet sawdust, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And it wouldn't be... You would never use dirt, really, to heal something in because the chances of it starting to root would be greater, and it would be harder to harvest it out of the healing in process.
Yeah, you could, in theory, do it in dirt if it was for a short time. Let's say you had some bare root trees and you were going to hang, and you got them in January and you weren't going to be ready to plant them until March. You could heal them in soil because they're not going to really start growing much until the soil warms up later on.
So healing in is just the process of putting the roots in some kind of medium. Sawdust is very common, but it's moist. It could be, I suppose, vermiculite or something, so the roots don't dry out.
That's right.
And it wouldn't be planted upright. Sometimes they're just on their sides.
Yep.
And you toss the sawdust or whatever over it.
Yep. Yeah,
it could be under 6 inches of it or whatever.
Yeah, and as we talked about, it's primarily used for bare root plants. If you leave it too long in the healed-in location, the plant will start to grow, then that gets to be dangerous because you don't want to get it. If it starts to grow much, transplanting then is going to be more difficult, and you're going to really, you could possibly kill the plant.
Regret it.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
Okay. So that's healing in. Okay. Well, we'll finish our program here, or at least part of it anyway, talking about slug control. Actually, we won't take all the time to do that. I do want to mention, too, about fertilizers, organic versus inorganic. But slug control, I'll just tell you what I do, and then I'll tell you what I've tried and what others try to with limited success. And then we'll also get to gopher and mole control, if you want to cover that, Jim. What I find most effective these days is using the baits that use iron phosphate as the active ingredient. These are not, they're considered organic products. They're approved for use in organic farms and gardens. They're not as toxic to mammals. I mean, what I've heard was that they're just pellets that you would put around, and you don't need very many for each plant or an area. But you would have to spread them over like a 10 by 10 foot area, and a dog would have to eat all of those in order to become sick. And so the chances of a accidental poisoning are just very slim. And that's opposed to the baits that have metaldehyde in them, like Deadline or Corey's Slug and Snail Killer, that the metaldehyde is a more toxic material to mammals. And with the iron phosphate baits, such as Slug-O or Escargot, and there's other just brands of that, the slug will eat it, and then you probably won't see it again. It just goes home for the day, and then it gets a stomach ache, and I'm not feeling so well tonight, I'm not going to go out. And so it doesn't. And it expires at home. Whereas the metaldehyde baits, you'll see it dehydrates them. Now, I've heard that it dehydrates, the metaldehyde baits will dehydrate for maybe 48 hours. And if you happen to have a very foggy or rainy day, 2 days, that the slug can survive that. But I don't know if that's true or not.
What I discovered, or at least read, and I think discovered, was that the iron phosphate baits, well, we use Slug-O, it dissolves in rain, and so you want to, if you're gonna, you don't want to apply it just before a rainstorm, because you'll lose it.
Then, yeah, you know? I think it can survive some rain. You know, the pellets are, you know, they're 1/16 of an inch wide or something like that, but it's also, you know, kind of acts as a fertilizer, you know, iron phosphate. Mm-hmm. But it's expensive fertilizer. So
That's right.
So Jim's advice is good. You know, wait.
Yeah, when you know the weather's going to be reasonable for a couple of days, then that would be the time to use it, in my opinion.
And I've mentioned this many times. You know, you do this show long enough, and we have. It's probably been a quarter of a century now, Jim. Can you believe that, Dan? It was the late 90s when the Dirtbag came to be.
How many children have been born since we started the show?
Yeah, people get bored and do other things. Is that what you're suggesting, Jim? No. Forgot what I was going to say about that. Oh, the time to bait is really before your plant. You just take care of those slugs that are in the area, and then you can plant and maybe add a little bit more bait. So treat prophylactically.
And some plants are more susceptible to slug damage. It's interesting.
Oh, yes.
Pawpaw. They love pawpaws.
Is that right?
And I had a funny experience a few years ago when I was out walking in the fall, in the evening, looking at some of my newly planted pawpaw trees, and I wondered, why don't they have leaves on them? So I went to look a little closer, and a lot of the leaves had been just really devoured, you know, like figured by slugs. So for some reason, I had a dream in the middle of the night about turtles, and I was on a boat, and turtles were all around me, and it woke me up, and I thought, I've got to go out there and look at those pawpaw plants, because the slugs are active at night.
Sure.
They're not out in the daytime. And I went out at about 3 a.m. and I started, and I took a Nancy's quart yogurt container with me, and I started collecting slugs, and I filled the yogurt container.
Oh my.
And I brought them back and showed it to the crew at the nursery. I was like, man, oh man, these guys were really going to town. So So if you have pawpaws, especially younger ones that are small trees, you know, you might notice that there's some damage.
Yeah,
you definitely want to.
They
try.
Like dahlias too.
Yeah, really. Yeah, oh, interesting.
Yep. Now, other methods that people try, and I have tried, but don't find it all that successful and satisfying and as easy. You hear about the beer you put the. Not the cheapest beer, the studies have shown, and the yeast in the beer and the whatever in the beer gives off somewhat of the same odors or attractants to slugs as rotting vegetation, and so they're attracted to that. They go to the beer, they drown. It's a lot of, it's a lot more work, and you do need to replenish the beer every so often, day or two, and get the slugs out. Get them in the sun. Whew, you won't want that. There's also using copper edges or copper things, just bands, if you will, putting them around your raised beds. I don't hear so much about that anymore. I think it can be effective. I did an experiment once, put a slug inside the copper band, just on a board or something in the sun. So it was either, bake in the sun for the slug or go over the copper barrier. It went over the copper barrier.
Mm.
The slug reacts somewhat to the copper. I'm not sure. But like I said, maybe it's not marketed as much that way anymore.
Yeah.
The two brick method can be quite effective. Just put a slug between two bricks, bring the bricks together.
I thought you were going to say, turn the brick over and see what's underneath.
Another method that I still use is to put boards out, old boards, fence boards or sometimes pieces of plywood, small pieces of plywood that are rotting and I'm not using for anything else, just on a bare bed or between plants. Leave it out for a couple of days and the slugs will congregate under there and they'll stick to the board for the most part when you pick it up and you can easily slice and dice. Mm-hmm. If you need to.
Mm-hmm.
So I use that method and the iron phosphate based baits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one final thing here before we say goodbye, and that is just a brief mention on organic versus inorganic fertilizers. I think the main takeaway that I would offer is that the plant can tell no difference between them. But the more important take-home message is the soil can. And when you use an organic fertilizer, you are relying on the soil organisms in order to break that down and make the nutrients available to the plants, because they're not generally in forms that the plants can use them. Inorganic fertilizers, which are generally and maybe exclusively made from petroleum products, natural gas and oil, they're refined, are in a form right now that the plant can use them. Nitrogen is, in a nitrite form or nitrates even, and the plant can readily take up those nitrogen molecules. But with blood meal, for example, very high in nitrogen, it's not in a form. And it needs the soil organisms, bacteria particularly, to transform it into the usable form, which is why organic fertilizers are much more effective in warmer weather when we have warmer soil. So the take-home message is, if you want to just boost your crops right now and ignore the soil health, which is what happened in the Midwest and why we had dust bowls and all of that following the Green Revolution, and the soils became sterile, if you will, go for an inorganic fertilizer.
That doesn't sound like a good recommendation, Glenn.
Well, you're right. You're on to me, Jim.
Yeah.
So, the overall long picture approach for your garden is the best, and that would be an organic fertilizer.
I might make a quick little recommendation. So we just did a bunch of that type of fertilizing on our some of our plants, our pawpaws in particular. There's a company right near us called Stutzman's that makes a composted chicken manure.
Oh, yeah.
That seems quite good. Plants love it, and soil likes it, and everything grows well.
Okay, well, that's a lot of information in one show for 2 months.
Yeah.
We will have a show in August, but we're going to have to record that one ahead of time because I will be at my very last Scandinavian festival where I have a Swedish pancake booth. And so that's during that time. But we'll be back live in September, hopefully right here at the station.
Just for listeners to know, where is this festival?
The Scandinavian Festival, Junction City, Oregon.
And the dates are that?
Oh, it's August 12th through the 15th or something like that, Thursday through Sunday.
Well, we should have a party there.
I won't have any energy to party.
Okay, all right. Well, I might come.
It's the hardest I work all year.
Yeah? Okay.
So that'll be the end. All right. Thank you, Ty. Appreciate your help there. We'll go out with our very last musical break. This is from Jeff Healey. Some of these days, some of these rainy days. We'll be back.
Some of these days, you'll miss me, honey. Some of these days, you're gonna be so lonely. You'll miss my hugging, you'll miss my kissing. You'll be so sorry, babe, when I'm away. Now you're gonna be lonely, just for me only. Cause you know, honey, that you had your way. And when you leave me, you know it'll grieve me. You're gonna miss your dad, daddy, some of these days.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is noon.